ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय. रीडिंग टुडे फ्रॉम श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 10 चैप्टर 1 एंटाइटल्ड द एडवेंट ऑफ लॉर्ड कृष्णा इंट्रोडक्शन टेक्स्ट नंबर 64. एतत् कंसाय भगवान् चशंसभ्येत्य नरद भूमेर्भारायमानानां दैत्यानां च वधोद्यममम्. ट्रांसलेशन and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Ishi Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation. Once the great saint Narad approached Kans and informed him of how the demoniac persons who were a great burden on the earth were going to be killed. Thus, Kans was placed into great fear and doubt. Purport. It has already been discussed that Mother Earth implored Lord Brahma to give her relief from the distress created by the burdensome demons, and that Lord Brahma informed her that Lord Krishna himself was going to appear. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 4.8, Paritranaya sadhuna vinashaya cha duskritam dharma samsthapanarthaya sambhavami yuge yuge. Whenever there is a burden created by the demons, and whenever the innocent devotees are distressed by demoniac rulers, the Lord appears in due course of time to kill the demons with the assistance of His real representatives, who are technically called demigods. In the Upanishads, it is stated that the demigods are different parts of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As it is the duty of the parts of the body to serve the whole, it is the duty of Krishna's devotees to serve Krishna as He wants. Krishna's business is to kill the demons. And therefore, this should be a devotee's business also. Because the people of Kali Yuga are fallen, however, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, out of kindness for them, did not bring any weapon to kill them. Rather, by spreading Krishna consciousness, love of Krishna, He wanted to kill their nefarious demoniac activities. This is the purpose of the Krishna consciousness movement. Unless the demoniac activities on the surface of the earth are diminished or vanquished, no one can be happy. The program for the conditioned soul is fully described in Bhagavad Gita, and one simply has to follow these instructions to become happy. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has therefore prescribed, Hare Naam, Hare Naam, Hare Naam Eva Kevalam, Kalo Nasteva 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 Gatir Anyatha. Let people chant the Hare Krishna mantra constantly, then their demoniac tendencies will be killed and they will become first-class devotees, happy in this life and in the next. So, we have all heard the story of Kans. We also know that he was the ruler of Mathura, and his power that he had. Actually, just imagine what such a personality, he invokes so much fear, tremendous intimidation. Anyone who was under his rule could not defy him. And this was a similar case in the case of Ravan or Jarasandh, other very great kings. They were tremendously successful because they had achieved anything that they wanted, and it is even beyond our imagination, because their success was far, far, many, many times more than what we could even dream of in this world, materially speaking also, because they had conquered their they had got all the siddhis, they had conquered all the demigods, all the planets. So with this kind of fear which they could invoke in others, and grudging respect because of their the strength of their position. If we just imagine such a personality, when what is it that could make him fearful and have doubts? And how is it possible that such a person would have fear and doubt? Now, we do know from the story that the minute he heard that, you know, he would be killed and the voice came from the skies, his whole personality changed. All the external facade that he presented of how he was extremely nice to his sister, he spontaneously volunteered to drive the chariot after her marriage to Vasudev. Everything changed in a split second. So this is a very revealing issue, because we can see that from here that even the heights of success that and the position that Kans had reached did not absolve him of fear and doubt. This is this. If we dwell on this, then and knowing that our position is not even a fraction of what that position is, then and if we know that the Shastras are true, then it goes without saying that we are also going to be affected by fear, by and by doubts. Now, doubt is something which Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that you know, for somebody who is for the doubting soul, there is happiness neither in this world nor in the next. And here in the purport, Prabhupada ends by saying that let people chant the Hare Krishna mantra constantly, then the demonic tendencies will be killed and they will become first-class devotees, happy in this life and the next. So it is really like a direct contrast to, we've got the two extremes, that the height of material success, which is represented by Kans, he's busy, and that is also at a very mature age, and he's not avoiding the doubts that he's that he should have, because if he was such a master, such a controller, he should have had no doubts. There's no question about his lacking anything. And here, Prabhupada is saying just the opposite, that not matter of caste or creed or position, age, height, whatever. It is just that if we just take to a process of chanting, we can be happy in this life and the next. So, this issue of doubt is something which we all face. I mean, anyone who begins spiritual life will be inundated by legions of doubts. And these doubts are of all types. We would be doubting God, we would be doubting ourselves, doubting the words of so many people we hear. I mean, it is natural to expect that when we walk in and suddenly, if we are a typical person, as whether in India or overseas, India may be less so, but we're walking or suddenly we are confronted or we are faced with a devotee or somebody asks us to come to the temple, so many questions will start going in our mind. So, and if we reflect, almost all of us would have gone through these questions. Rare is the soul who, the minute he saw saffron or a Bhagavad Gita, and bing, you know, his mood completely got realization. At least I haven't met such a person yet. So initially there would be doubt. There would be perhaps an attraction also. There would be some intrigue. There would be there'd also be a comfort level, but still there'll be questions. And the questions could be many about whether this person is genuine, whether his movement is genuine. So many foreigners we see. Whether the rich people, when they come in and devotees are kind to them, they may think that whether he's after my money. You know, that is natural. So these questions would have come at some point, but it is through the eyes of knowledge and through the submissive hearing that we gradually are able to reduce these doubts. And slowly, when we are able to, and submissive means we are with our eyes and ears open, especially our ears, that we are actually, our hearts are open, that we are willing to understand and receive before we judge. Because then the transcendental sound vibration can enter our hearts and can start changing our consciousness and our perception, because it is such a radical change. See, this we are totally brainwashed or conditioned to be thinking on the material level, on a bodily level. Immediately, all our needs are primarily on that basis. Our concept of religion typically, at best, would have been that we are pious, we would go to the temple. But most of all, what we are thinking of constantly would be our anxieties, would be how do I get my, if we're in school, how do I get my marks, in college, how do we improve our, what is my career, where will I go further, how will I, which job I get. And if we are, let's say, a software engineer and, we have done an MBA and then we get a job offer, in a multinational, so we are very happy. So we really feel we achieve something. So this is what consumes our mind. Then when we are married, we have to settle with our family, and then we get a house, we can take a loan. There's an anxiety. Once we get the loan, then we get a good job and we're able to pay. We really feel we've achieved something. So the entire life cycle is very much around our immediate needs. So therefore, when we come across a situation like we would, where a genuine organization, genuine devotees who are representing the true words of what Krishna said, are actually presenting something on the level of spirit soul. When they're not concerned at all with the externals. They're not concerned at all with the externals, like we may have 5 degrees behind us, or we may have crores in the bank, we may be very good looking, we may be the top of Bollywood, whatever. Doesn't concern them. What concerns them is how they can engage this fortunate soul who has now come in contact with some form of the deity or the Lord, can actually gain the real knowledge. That is the only concern. And in that concern, in that process, slowly depending on the reaction of the newcomer, they would try to engage them according to their propensity and their background and what they have. So therefore, to digest that itself, it is so, now if we see, it is so straightforward. What is, everyone says, oh, this is wonderful. Someone who comes with faith and someone who comes with without motivation, there's no problem, I'm very happy. But at that time, our consciousness would be such that we would doubt everything. That even a person who is not at all motivated, we will be perceiving motives. Because we have motives. So our mind reflects the thoughts and about what the other person may be coming. So because of that, therefore we need patience, we need to hear submissively. So that is why the environment is needed, wherein we are able to gradually come to a level where we are then able to absorb this knowledge. Otherwise, it becomes very difficult if it is only at a superficial level. And if you look at this, that the biggest enemy of doubt and of faith would be doubt. This doubt and disbelief would be totally counter to this. So if we really want to have faith in the process that it works, we have to see that we go to the root and how we can remove this demon of doubt. And we're not talking of doubts about, mundane doubts, it's not like there are many things in our occupational needs, our house, or in our environment outside, where we may be wondering whether this may happen, that may happen. These are there will be millions of those. That's not the important thing. Is about the goal of life or about our lifestyle, about the key things that we are pursuing, and whether we have any worries on that score. So that is where we have doubts. And we have the example of Arjun as a person who had great faith in Krishna. See, before the battle of Kurukshetra, he was given this choice between accepting Lord Krishna's great army, which was huge and very powerful, on one hand, and on the other hand, but that would be without Krishna himself. And on the other hand, he would have a small army, and he would have Krishna, but as his charioteer. And immediately he chose Krishna as the charioteer, not without the army. He had that faith. But nonetheless, the same Krishna, the same Arjun, later, when the battle was about to start, he had so many doubts. But because he was a sincere soul and he was, as Krishna said, that you are my friend And you know, he was also, and he was a devotee, because he was, he, his faith was, I mean, his questions and doubts were based on very genuine worries about the welfare of his uncle and grandfather and people whom he loved. And his perception, his motives were very clear, but his perception was faulty. And therefore, when Krishna tells him that, you know, therefore your doubts should be slashed by the weapon of knowledge, and armed with yoga, O Arjun, you know, you get up and stand up and fight. So Krishna, Arjun then realizes that. And at the end of the whole Bhagavad Gita recitation, he tells Krishna that now my doubts are all gone. I am completely free of any doubt, willing to take on, act according to your words. So that process that lasted, say, an hour and a half on the battlefield of Bhagavad Gita is the process of our whole life. Now, it may last 30 years, 50 years, 70 years, but ultimately in the passage of time, it is just that. So it is a matter of start to finish. The start of a spiritual life is when we surrender to a process, and the end is when we, when Krishna is fully satisfied. Krishna is happy and we are completely surrendered. Now, if we may not complete it in this lifetime, Krishna is so merciful that he will give opportunities, and once we join the process, eventually we will come to him. Also, we talked about fear. Now, when Kansa was, had doubt and fear. So, it is interesting to see that doubt, delusion and fear are all interrelated. Now, actually, doubt comes from delusion. Delusion is when somebody thinks that the unreal is real, and he cannot distinguish between matter and spirit. Ultimately, that means we know that we are the spirit soul in reality. And we have a body which has to be functioning and which we need to cater to, but at a subservient level. But trying to focus on the issue of what the needs of the real me are, that is the soul. So that, so a person who is in delusion cannot distinguish between matter and spirit, and is, you know, so, and because of that he has doubts, because all activities are surrounding his body. If a person is completely consumed by needs of the body is all in all. How, and body, it could be the physical form, like somebody, there are many more and more now who, for whose great consciousness is to, you know, see that how they can build their body, make it more beautiful, make it more luxurious, you know, luxurious hair and cosmetics, and the whole industry, like we'll say 100 years passage of time, with the advent of industrialization, how much tens of billions of dollars, hundreds of billions, has created industries which are, in one sense, completely a waste of time, because they are totally temporary and also they are, in fact, misleading. But ultimately, that is going to the same route where it is enhancing the body. And therefore, a person who is in that bodily consciousness would be completely, his world is surrounded by that. And therefore, the doubts come. Therefore, the fear of death comes. Because ultimately, fear, we may not be thinking of death all the time, but eventually, basically, the main fear is of death. Initially, you can say, I mean, when we look at that, what am I fear? The fear is, you can define it as something which is consuming us about the future. You know, we are always worrying about, so fearfulness is something about the future, that what will happen. I expect this to happen, or I expect that to happen, this may not happen. It's not so much about the past, it's usually about the future. And but eventually, the root of that is, you'll find it is in the fear of death, because death means ultimately we give up everything and we don't know where we will go, and we don't know where our assets will go, and we'll be deprived of that. Yeah, I mean, there are many examples of the kind of doubts that we are besieged with. I just mentioned a few, that when Prabhupada, in 69, when the moon landing took place, that was, even devotees who were in the movement for 1 or 2 years, when Prabhupada said that the moon is further than the sun and they must have landed somewhere else, a lot of people affected, even in the small fledgling movement, and people left. Even people who have genuine desire to come after some time, say, for instance, I have seen these cases, like sometimes the wife starts wondering, if the husband gets too serious, there's a doubt that, you know, whether he'll leave me, whether he'll leave his job, whether he'll leave the security. There's also a doubt. So it takes time before, and sometimes the behavior of the husband also could be such where, you know, he's acts almost on a fanatical basis, so, you know, that also increases the doubt. But even if he's sincere, that is a, it is a doubt which is not unusual, it happens. Or the husband may feel that the wife is getting too serious and neglecting the house, and then the ego comes in the way that I'm not being served, my house is not being looked after. So you can have contrasts, but these are all things which could happen not only at the beginning but even during the course of the of several years. That even after some time, initially we may really like, because there's a contrast. We meet people who are completely different, genuine people who are very much different than the ones we meet outside. So there's an attraction. And then when we go further, we like the philosophy. But when we further go and then say somebody gets initiated, then that causes a worry. Now is it getting too much? So we have certain, till we dispel our concepts, because our concept is that yes, there is a window for religiosity, for spiritualness, but it is a window. We have many windows, so we open one window at a time, and we have other windows also. But so that is our mentality, because we have our concept. Eventually, when we understand that all that activities that we do can be spiritual or material, it is not that when we go out of the temple we are now non-spiritual, or that we get into vehicle and go to the office and not in spiritual, or we go to other some mundane activities. The wife may go to buy vegetables. Now that is spiritual activities stop, and now material activities start. It is not like, so this takes time. So this is the patience. Why patience is needed is because in that process, as we saw in Arjun's case, right through it takes gradually one step at a time before that before the philosophy sinks in. And then conversely, if you look at what Krishna says about his devotee, he says that somebody who actually faithfully follows his path, he is actually he will be fearless, and because he is convinced that his activities are not on the material level. And Krishna proclaims, tells Arjuna, you proclaim it boldly that my devotee shall never perish, which is a very, very I would say very unambiguous, very clear statement. You can't have more clearly, and that too, Krishna tells him to say, proclaim it boldly. So Krishna understands that this statement will make waves, right? For probably eons. But that is really what a sincere devotee who is seeking genuine spiritual understanding will actually take great relief from, to know that that we will not miss, the soul will never perish. Krishna will always protect our spiritual endeavors, no matter what the difficulties are going to come. Yeah, it is also said that in Kali Yuga, there was a statement which came in one of the articles in the BTG, that in Kali Yuga, the population is just a royal addition of animals. So it's something which is which also worth understanding, that because when you talk of an addition means just the contents are the same. There may be minor changes here and there, but it is, when it's a revised edition, edition number two, edition number three, and when you say royal edition means it is like a coffee book table, coffee table, this thing, which is really fancy, that might sell for 100 rupees, this might sell for 1,000 rupees, nicely bound, very nicely packaged, with great, covering, etc. But finally, the contents are the same. So basically, why is it said in such a harsh way? But it is realistic, because actually, the same fears And the same self-preservation instincts that the animals have, the humans also have, because we the only distinguishing feature, as we know, is the human can think, and if he doesn't really think about the genuine issues about what is happening, how we are aging, how the life is moving, where we are going to leave this world, where did we come from, etc., then there's no difference. Other things are all on a level where it is not the final intelligence, it is, you can say, relative intelligence. But the absolute truth is something which needs to be, which has to be seen, which has to be explored. And why is it considered foolish for someone who doesn't take to spiritual life? Because we also know the consequences if we understand the science of karma, the cycle of karma, that actually what happens if the if we lead a degraded life. So we could actually have next time the body of a dog or a hog or a cat or a fish or a handicapped human. Now that means it is real foolishness or recklessness where we are willing to risk that just for a few years in one life, we are willing to risk so many years of gradual evolution that has taken place when we move through the ranks and come to a human species, and again we are going to go back to perhaps many lifetimes, not perhaps, certainly many lifetimes, and perhaps thousands of lifetimes, millions of lifetimes again, just for the sake of the few years of momentary complete abstinence of spiritual understanding. And we can see also from the story of Pralambasur, you know, he was a demon who was killed by Lord Balaram, as to how the how subtle situations can be, because Pralambasur actually came as a cowherd boy, and he was trying to kill, and he understood that Krishna is too powerful, so he thought he will try to kill Lord Balaram. So therefore, his attack was to go indirectly, and then after killing Balaram, he felt that Lord Krishna will not want to live, and then he will also die, and then others will also not, they can't live without Krishna, because Krishna lives only for his devotees. So the analogy is that, the parallel is that when we have doubts and worries, these doubts, if we don't really resolve it, even in spiritual life, will actually eat into the root. Just like Krishna is a root for all his devotees. Ultimately, as we water the root, we know that the tree flowers. Just by watering a leaf, the nourishment doesn't go and the tree will be dead. But if you go to the root, then the water is effective. Same way here, for devotees, the nourishment is glorifying Krishna, following his instructions, chanting his name, reading about him. Now, if that is affected, just like Pralambasura was trying to maneuver indirectly, here this maneuvering comes when our faith is shaken. And why? Because ultimately, what is the nourishment for a devotee? It's a faith and devotion. So that faith and devotion is the root for our attachment to Krishna. If that gets shaken, then then that could be disaster. And the real worry is that we are not even aware of how this could work around us. You know, if there's a direct enemy, if somebody walks in with a sword and wants to kill us, we have fear, but it's in black and white. Either you live or you die, you fight or you run, but you don't have to think, you know, you can work with instinct. While here, in this kind of situation where there is no clarity, it is a very, very gradual process by which all things around us will slowly, slowly move towards shaking our faith. And if we don't protect that, then we are putting it at great risk. There is an example. For instance, if you take one example of like in Western schools, And perhaps in many schools in India, at least in the big cities, they're not allowed to take the name of God. And they're also not allowed to say there is no God. They just don't mention about God. Now, so this is as per the secular principles. And this is in virtually all Western countries. Now, with the result that one may say that, well, there's a neutral position. But the way the contents of the literatures and whatever we do, I mean, day in and day out, about the theory of creation and so many aspects of life, there's no mention of God, there's no mention of no God. So they are, strictly speaking, neutral, technically correct. But if one goes through that, eventually we'll grow into feeling that there is absolutely no place for God in this life. So the purpose is achieved. So this is really the danger where our faith can be shaken, where we may not realize, and because then there is a substitute, the values would be based on our material comforts. And it may also have a level of some philanthropic tinge. It may also be not necessarily only, you know, if we have reached a certain level of wealth, we may be inclined to also consider, okay, I can also help others, I would like to do this, I would like to do that. And then we appease ourselves thinking that, yes, you know, I want to be good, I want to be moral, I want to follow that. But without God, you can't have moral principles, because there needs to be an absolute standard. You can't have a relative standard of morality, because otherwise each one can interpret the way, it is a highly subjective view. Each one can think, I'm doing good. If you go and ask any sane person, sane means who's not mentally imbalanced, each one will think that I'm really, I'm doing fine, and I'm also, I'm not harming anyone, I'm doing the best what I can for others. So similarly, the community will, which is a collection of people, will also think like that. Similarly, the country also thinks like that. Today, if you see, no country, within the country, they don't feel that they're doing anything wrong, because the leaders would think that we are doing for our country. So there is a national spirit. You know, they put their hand on their heart and say that we are doing what we want. So then everything goes. Now, there is no moral principles which are laid down as under spiritual guidelines. Because when we talk of spirit soul, it brings it breaks all definitions of countries, caste, education, etc. It puts us straight on the focus of children of God, and that we look at everything as a property of God. Sorry. So that is very difficult for them to accept. So that is why the whole approach becomes completely vitiated. So any theories that are brought in, or any approach for our future gain, may sound very nice, but if we do not see it from the learned devotees, people who are having a real understanding of spiritual knowledge, we could be very much misled. Another example is everybody's concerned with their own economic development. This is almost the first principle of virtually everyone, that they would like to do well materially, they like to have some money in the bank, would like to, you know, have a good job and good occupation, save something for their children. So there is a family feeling, which is nice. So because of that, they want to do. So they say, what is wrong with that? Nothing wrong with that. But what is it that leads us? Now, we are constantly told everywhere, if you just spend perhaps from the 20s to the 40s or 50s, you know, by that time, if you've gone through 10 or 20 years of whether you, if you are in any profession, or if you're working, or if you have your own job, or if your own company, everywhere the principle followed is that we must increase growth. The company's, the country's growth is equivalent to improvement in our life. So that becomes a complete axiomatic truth, actually, for us, that yes, the growth, anything happens, this is affecting growth. Now, the growth is one side of the coin. The other side of the coin of what was called growth is exploitation, is environmental degradation, is competitiveness, is family breakdowns, is increase in crime, is reckless behavior. This is the other side. So in the pursuit of growth, in the rich and poor divide, ultimately we are talking of growth to so-called solve the economic problems and to see that there is no poverty. That's what we hear all the time. But this is designed by people, only those who are in power. If you have 600,000, we have 600,000 villages in India, and we have 700 million people staying in the villages. You will not find them talking of growth. That farmer who's tilling the farm, he's not saying, India's growth has not slipped from 8.2 to 8%. I'm really worried. They don't know. What is it? No, whether it is 3% or whether it's 10%. So this growth and the carving out of the so-called, you know, gross development product or the total output, and then it is carved. It is like Prabhupada said, honor among thieves. You know, each one, so those who are in the control will have it according to theirs. So countries which are rich will design for their own self-preservation, for their own national interest, national, so quote-unquote, will do anything to preserve that. They can have wars, they can, and they have had, I mean, this is, the, it is, there's no speculation. Countries have gone to war in the recent past because a critical resource may be not be available after some time, so they want that. But they'll design a war because the industry also, defense industry is very important. So all this becomes a view because of stability in their, there's no spiritual understanding at all or no desire for spiritual understanding. So we have to protect, the point is that we have to protect that we don't get carried away by that, and our faith should not be shaken. Because if the doubts start coming, then it is, there's a relationship between trust in God and doubt. It is inversely proportional. To the extent that we trust the Lord, trust Krishna, to that extent He will open Himself to us, He will reveal Himself to us, and then our doubt goes down. So more trust, less doubt. And less trust, more doubt. This is very automatically, like it's inversely proportional. So that is why if we are looking for understanding the reality of the world as the days tick by, moments tick by, years tick by, and we are gradually moving, so a sensible person would like to understand and see how he can then dovetail it, dovetail all his occupational needs and other relevant issues which are, you know, for the family, for the community, for parents, for etc., for emergencies, can do it along with, without, in fact, making it a subservient principle to the all-consuming importance of having the Lord in the center and letting Him guide our life. And here in the purport, Krishna also Prabhupada also talks about Lord Chaitanya's movement, and that is very interesting because. We talked of Kans. We are talking of Kans now and about his fear and death. Now, Kans was dragged by his hair by Krishna at the end, and he was pummeled, you know, he was bludgeoned, I mean, he was, you know, fisted and killed, and he was liberated. The same Kans came as Chand Kazi in Lord Chaitanya's advent. And Lord Chaitanya came into this movement. Amazingly, he came into this movement for various reasons. Yesterday, Muralidhara Prabhu mentioned about the advent of the Lord, the reasons that he comes in. Certainly, he comes to, you know, destroy the demons and protect the devotees. But when he came here, and there are so many ways that Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu transformed people's lives by the process of the chanting of the holy name. He was extremely kind to them. He was begging everyone to take the names, and when they took to the names, they saw the transformations. And Chand Kazi is one amazing transformation where he was a very powerful ruler, and when he had being a Muslim ruler, he had made a prince law. In fact, he had outlawed any kind of kirtan or congregational chanting, because that was the basis on which the holy name was being was going all around, and he broke a mridanga. But he personally led the people, his army, and to the streets, and he broke the mridanga. And when Lord Chaitanya came to know, he was so upset, so angry, transcendently angry, that he actually mobilized millions of people and said that we will have Harinam Sankirtan on the road. Prabhupada describes it as the first civil disobedience movement in the history. The later ones were only in the last century. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there was no political motive. It was to transform, to liberate the people from the birth and death cycle. So then he organized it, and you know, then Chand Kazi was very fearful, and then he because when he came out and saw that there were literally millions on the road, all with the torches, the sticks with cloths and the burning, and imagine just walking down the streets towards him. But he had the sense that when he discussed, and he got convinced by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he allowed he proclaimed that the holy name will continue forever. My successors and all who will come, they will they'll be happy to allow the holy name, and it is still being followed. So there were Jagai and Madai, there were scholars, all kinds of people who were transformed by Lord Chaitanya. But there was a class of people who was totally against it still. And because Navadvip was a seat of learning, and there, but then they were totally misinformed. So they had complete misconceptions on several things. Even in those days, the cats and dogs marriages took place, a lot of money was spent on that. It was not only when our princes came, it is mentioned. So all kinds of things were done which were completely like serpents and ghosts were being worshipped and so on. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu destroyed a lot of it, but still the small section that remained, who were not converted to him, were not the simple illiterate people. They were the so-called Brahmin class, the educated class, which is quite significant to note. If you see in today's world also, the simpler people have no difficulty in accepting on faith. It's the really when we have when we think we have gained lot of the our intellect or resources, then we have difficulty. So those people were having great difficulty in accepting Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's and especially there's one event which when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was in Vraj Bhav, and he was he became ecstatic and was proclaiming Gopi Gopi, running on the streets, couldn't control his transcendental symptoms. At that time, these people were mocking him, and also they were criticizing him. That was the defining moment when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu felt that it's, as I say, the straw that breaks the camel's back, as His Holiness Radhanath Swami spoke in his lecture, that this was a sign. He took it that till he remains an ordinary grihastha, they will not accept and respect him. But he will have to change. He'll have to get the respect so that they can then listen to him. So the significant point is the sacrifice that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu made, that he actually took sannyas, because the devotees were very happy, most ecstatic, just having him with him, just seeing his relationship with his mother, his wife, and seeing his beautiful hair, etc. But it was for the sake of those who hated him that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took sannyas. That was his ultimate and tremendous sacrifice. So we are so fortunate that we are in this parampara without even knowing it. It's like somebody just, we have been brought to the room, bandages from our eyes is removed, and we find suddenly we are in a treasure house. We don't know where we came from, how we came from, who brought us, and nothing. It's like our position is just like that. But the sensible person is someone who will say, okay, now what can I do to remain here? What can I do to cultivate my spiritual understanding, such that we can play, a very treasurable and pleasurable role in whatever way we can to come closer to the people who have brought us to this movement, people who have given us this opportunity for spiritual life. So I'll end here. Any questions or comments? Mike.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji. Prabhuji, if we are talking about the fear and the doubt in Kansa, I feel that Kansa had never had any doubt that he will be killed by the Lord. Rather, he had a full faith and confidence that he will be killed by the God. And that's why he did what he did. And that's why all the 12 years till he was dead, he was very Krishna conscious and to all the 24 hours Krishna conscious. So how come a demon like him had such a big faith in Krishna and such a big big Krishna consciousness in Krishna?
He didn't have faith in Krishna. He definitely was thinking of Krishna all the time, but that was out of fear. So he was consumed by fear. In fact, that also is an example of how much fear can make a person 24 hour conscious of their object. You can imagine when we are fearful in any situation, it is not a pleasurable situation. I mean, nobody likes to be in fear, even for a moment. And we all go through some moments, but that moments pass. It is not like every second, every minute, every hour, every day we are in. And it is described in graphic detail how he was seeing all kinds of objects, and he was seeing 10 heads when he saw the mirror and all kinds of things. A person of this kind of power, intelligence and control. So they describe in great detail the fear he went through. So it's a miracle that he didn't commit suicide or something, because you know because that kind of fear, you know, that if you go to see persons who commit suicide now, I mean, there must be in such such miserable mental condition. And here he was thinking of Krishna, but it was not without of ecstasy. Very happy. He was actually out of fear. And therefore, he did get liberated when he was killed. But he was not leading a life thinking that I'm looking for the moment when Krishna will beat me to death. He was not happily looking forward to it. He wanted to kill Krishna, but he got killed. Like to add something?
Hare Krishna. I was just sharing with Brajavasi Prabhu. I was thinking always, you know, Krishna is the greatest of everyone. How can Krishna be the greatest terrorist? So today I got the answer. He put Kamsa, the super terrorist, under terror for 12 years continuously.
Actually, it is said in the Bhagavatam that when we chant the holy name of the Lord, the holy name has such, the sound vibration of the holy name has such potency that it puts terror in fear itself. So as Radha Gopinath was saying, that actually it's difficult for us to understand that, because fear for us is a very intimidating object. How can we expect that to be fearful and if it's, to be terrorized? Any other questions or comments? Granthra Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.